Many people are aware of the rental income, resale profit, and tax shelter benefits of real estate. However, few purchasers are aware that you can actually obtain cash at the closing in a real estate transaction. As an investor, you will undoubtedly purchase properties for less than their market value, leaving equity in the property. Through careful planning, you can structure your transactions to not only purchase property with no money down, but also to get cash at closing. In this chapter, I'm going to present techniques that you can use to make your closing day a payday. To successfully get cash at closing, you must have a good understanding of your closing costs and loan terms. Planning is the key to this approach. If you're not sure about all the charges and costs, you won't know how much money will need to be borrowed or credited to enable you to get cash at closing. I want to describe for you seven different techniques that should provide you with a good foundation to plan for cash at closing. Let's start with the first one, financing and wise planning. You can often get cash back by obtaining financing and wisely planning the costs and credit related to your closing. As with any technique, it's important to understand your loan terms. Specifically, to structure a transaction where you get cash at closing, you should know the answers to the following questions, which could be obtained from your loan officer. If the purchase price differs from the appraised value, which figure will the lender use to determine the loan amount? What will be the amount of the loan? Will the lender allow credits at closing from the seller for closing costs, repairs, and the like? How much of a tax proration will the lender allow? Will the lender allow you to receive cash at closing? Will the lender allow a next day or same day refinance or letter of credit? Once you know the answers to these questions, you're ready to find a property and seller that fit your loan parameters. Ideally, the appraised value of the property should be greater than the amount the seller is willing to accept. To avoid potential appraisal valuation problems, you should keep in mind that appraisers rarely appraise property for more than the sale or list price. In addition, it is best to ask the appraiser to provide you with a free preliminary estimate of value prior to authorizing and paying for an actual appraisal report. You can also get an online automated property evaluation at my website, carltonsheets.com. Seek out a seller who is willing to accept less than the appraised value on the sale of his or her property. If you secure 100% financing and obtain a lender approval for credits, the difference between the seller's desired cash out and the property's value is the amount you can use to cover closing costs and put in your pocket. To illustrate this technique, assume that you obtain a loan approval for 100% financing on a $100,000 purchase. The lender will allow the seller to credit up to 5% of the purchase price toward repairs and 3% toward closing costs. The loan closing cost will be $2,000. You locate a property that your appraiser confirms will appraise at $100,000. The seller of the property needs a quick sale and informs you that if he could get $85,000, he would sell immediately. The property has no mortgage and is habitable, but could use kitchen and bathroom upgrades. Now, there are several ways that you can structure a purchase to cash out some or all of the $15,000 in remaining value. Remember, $100,000 market value less $85,000 sales price in the property. One solution is to offer $91,000 for the property and request a $4,000 credit for repairs and a $2,000 credit for closing costs. Based on this offer, the seller would receive $85,000. $91,000 that you're offering minus $4,000 credit minus $2,000 credit. At closing, all of your costs would be covered and the closing agent would give you a check for $4,000. If you complete the repairs for less than $4,000, the remainder would be cash in your pocket. The same technique can be used when even larger sums are paid at closing. If your repair credit is higher than 5% of the purchase price, however, the lender will probably require that the credit be paid to a third-party contractor. This contractor should be one with whom you have a consistent and ongoing relationship. Another technique. In addition to negotiating closing costs and repair credits, you can also try to negotiate higher credits for items usually paid by the seller. Such items include tax credits and rent credits. You can further increase the cash in your pocket at closing by negotiating to have the seller pay costs that might normally be charged to the buyer. Transfer tax, title charges, and loan charges are examples of costs you could shift to the seller's side of the closing statement. Remember, saving money on closing costs is just like making money. In many jurisdictions, the real estate tax for a given year is billed in the following year, due in part to the fact that tax rates are recalculated each year. This is important to you as a buyer because it means that when you close your purchase, there is a real estate tax bill looming in the future that the seller has not received or paid. Most contracts try to account for this anticipated future expense in one of two ways, either a tax reproration agreement or a tax proration agreement. Under a tax reproration agreement, the buyer and seller agree that when the actual bill is issued, each party will pay their share of the tax bill based on the amount of time that each owned the property. That is, if the seller owned the property for half a year and the buyer owned the property for the other half, they would split the tax bill 50-50. In most cases, this method is not used because the seller usually wants to be free from any and all obligations regarding the property. And the buyer is usually not interested in trying to track down the seller to collect the seller's share of the taxes. By contrast, a tax proration agreement calls for the buyer and seller to estimate how much the tax bill will be. Then the seller will pay a share of the estimated bill based on the amount of time he owned the property. It's customary for the seller and buyer to estimate the amount of the tax bill not yet billed based on an agreed-upon percentage of the most recent tax bill, for example, of 110% of last year's bill. Lenders are aware of the need for a tax proration and allow the seller to credit the buyer for taxes that are the seller's responsibility but that will be billed after the buyer closes. You can use this to your advantage by negotiating as high a tax proration as possible. The amount of the credit might be limited by your lender. The following example demonstrates negotiating a higher tax credit to get cash at closing. Assume that in your search for a new home, you come across a vacant two-story home that fits your housing needs. The seller has already relocated and is anxious to sell the home. You've obtained a loan approval for 100% financing. The loan approval provides that the seller can pay your closing costs from the proceeds of the loan. The property's most recent tax bill was $2,485. The property's been on the market for some time, and the seller is very motivated. The seller is willing to pay all your closing costs plus pay 125% tax proration. You also convince the seller to file for a tax reduction with a local assessor to reduce the property taxes. In the jurisdiction where the property is located, vacancy is grounds for tax relief. Based on the filing, property taxes can be reduced to $1,200. At closing, which takes place at the year's end, thus a full year's tax credit is due, the lender gives you a loan for 100% of the purchase price. The seller pays all your closing costs. You receive a check at closing for $3,106, which is 125% of the most recent tax bill of $2,485. You can now set aside $1,200 to pay the anticipated tax bill and put $1,906 in your pocket. Another technique, land contracts. Land contracts can enable you to receive a tremendous amount of cash at closing, as you'll see in a moment. As you may recall from our chapter titled Using Creative Financing Techniques, land contracts allow the buyer to purchase property through a series of installment payments. Technically, the closing of a land contract occurs when the buyer receives a deed to the property once the final installment payment has been made. However, when the land contract is executed, the buyer is given rights to the property. The buyer can and should record the land contract, or at least a memorandum of land contract, to give notice to others of the buyer's rights. The fact buyers who use land contracts can utilize refinance loans to pay off the land contract is a major benefit to the use of land contracts. Refinance loans are entirely different than purchase loans. A buyer gets a purchase loan when he or she has no real or equitable interest in the property being financed. The purchase loan amount is usually a percentage of the purchase price. For example, you may get a loan amount equal to anywhere between 80 and 100% of the purchase price. On the other hand, a refinance loan is given to a person that has real or equitable interest in the property being financed. In addition, the loan amount is based on the property's value, not on the contract purchase price. Because the refinance loan amount is based on the property's value, it can exceed the amount of both the purchase price and the closing costs. If the refinance loan amount exceeds the amount needed to pay off the remaining contract amount along with any costs, the buyer is able to keep the additional money. Here's an example of how this technique would work. Assume that you locate a property that the owner is having a difficult time renting. It appears that the owner just doesn't have time to market the property correctly or bring out its appeal to prospective renters. You propose to the seller that he consider selling the property to you on a land contract instead of renting it. Your investigation of the market in the property's area reveals that the property is worth about $110,000. You evaluate the property yourself and determine that it could use some painting and carpeting and a few upgrades. You offer the seller an $85,000 purchase price on a land contract with a balloon payment due in 5 years. You also offer the seller, who is trying to get $700 a month in rent, $800 a month on a land contract on the condition that he apply $200 of your monthly payment toward the purchase price and that your first payment is not due until 60 days from the date the contract is signed. The other $600 of your monthly payment is considered to be interest to the seller. To help sell your offer, you explain to the seller that he will get a higher payment than he even expected for the property, and in addition, you'll be fixing up the property at your expense. This way, in a worst-case scenario, the seller will get a nice monthly payment and an improved property if you fail to complete the land contract purchase. The seller accepts, and within 60 days, you upgrade the property and locate a tenant who will pay $900 a month in rent to help cover your contract payments and expenses. As with all land contracts, you have the right to lease this property. 4 months later, when the property is occupied and spruced up, you get a value estimate from an appraiser. The estimate reveals that the property would appraise for $115,000. You also check with your mortgage broker, who informs you that she has a loan program that would enable you to get a loan equal to 90% of the property's appraised value. In this case, that would be $103,500 at 7% interest, and the monthly principal and interest payments would be $688.59. You then calculate the numbers to see if you can pay off the land contract and put cash in your pocket at the same time. In this case, the amount to refinance the loan is $103,500, and the remaining balance due on the contract is $84,200, which means you put $19,300 cash in your pocket at closing. In addition to this cash, you have a property with a positive cash flow of more than $2,400 per year and $12,500 in equity. Another technique for generating cash is assigning your contract rights. The right to assign a contract is the right to allow someone else to take your place as the buyer in the contract. Now, unless your contract specifically provides you with the right to assign the contract, the seller is not necessarily obligated to let you assign. That can vary depending upon the state you're in, however. The right to assign a contract can be a very valuable asset. If you have the contract rights to a desirable property, but are unable to complete the transaction, an assignment allows you to cash in on your advantageous contract position rather than just lose your right to purchase the property. If you have the right to assign your contract, you could perhaps sell that right to someone else for $10,000 or more. That would probably justify the work you put into negotiating the transaction. Let's take a look at an example of making money by using the right to assign. Let's say you've negotiated the purchase of a 3-unit building in an up-and-coming area. You negotiated a below-market purchase, and the seller agrees to provide financing. The seller is getting up in years and doesn't want to deal with a building maintenance. The property appraised for $260,000, but the seller agreed to sell it to you for $215,000 and take back a note for $21,500. A month before the closing, you locate a 12-unit building in the same area that you would rather buy. You consider buying both, but decide that the 12-unit building would benefit from your personal management and will require a substantial time investment on your part. There's an investor in your investment club that's been looking for a good 2- or 3-flat property to invest in. You tell this novice investor that if he pays you $10,000 cash, you will assign the right to the contract over to him, and he will be able to purchase a property substantially below market value with the assistance of seller financing. The result? Win-win-win. You get $10,000 in cash, the seller sells a property she wants to get rid of, and the novice investor gets a 3-unit building with $45,000 in equity. Another technique for generating cash is a sale-leaseback technique. Another way to get cash at closing is to purchase property and lease it back to the seller. This is known as a sale-leaseback technique. This technique is most widely used in commercial settings where the seller is a business owner seeking to cash out the equity in his or her business property to generate operating capital. Under this technique, the seller becomes a tenant on the property that he or she formerly owned. Often the seller must pay standard lease and option fees at the closing. This technique also works well with residential properties. It's particularly effective in cases where the seller or homeowner is facing foreclosure. Sometimes you can find a property with substantial equity that is in mortgage or tax foreclosure. For example, because the owner experienced a temporary loss of income. If the owner is now able to make the required monthly payments but is unable to pay the tax deficiency, you could offer to purchase the home and lease it back to the owner with an option to buy. To illustrate the use of this technique, assume that you find a property that is facing foreclosure. The property's appraised value is $85,000. The owner has a $65,000 mortgage on the property but fell behind due to a job layoff. The owner is behind 8 payments for a total including fees and costs of $5,000. The owner recently returned to work and, although incapable of paying off the $5,000 delinquency, is capable of paying $800 per month in rent. The owner is unable to get a refinance loan because the late mortgage payments have damaged his credit. You offer to purchase the property for $80,000 and lease it back to the seller with an option to purchase. You set the option price at $85,000 with a $10,000 non-refundable deposit to be paid up front out of the closing proceeds. And this deposit will not apply to the option price. The option price is the amount the seller will have to pay to repurchase the home. The $10,000 non-refundable deposit is the payment made by the seller in exchange for the right to repurchase the home. To purchase the property, you obtain a loan for $80,000 with 100% financing. With the $80,000, you pay off the $65,000 mortgage and $5,000 in costs and fees and keep $10,000 for yourself as the non-refundable deposit on the lease option. It is as if that seller gave you the $10,000. The seller saves his property from foreclosure and obtains the option to repurchase the property at the end of the lease term. If the seller exercises the option to purchase, you receive $800 per month in rent until the option is exercised and collect another $5,000 at closing. The $5,000 is the difference between the option purchase price of $85,000 and the $80,000 borrowed to purchase the home. If the seller defaults or decides not to exercise the option, you own a property with at least $5,000 in equity, that is the $85,000 market value minus the $80,000 mortgage you have, and you have $10,000 in cash plus any rent payments collected. While this technique is fair and equitable, you are really acting as a good Samaritan to a seller who is down and out. Despite that, be careful. In some jurisdictions, the difference between the purchase price and the option price may be labeled as an illegal rate of interest, that is, usury. I recommend that you have an attorney in your area advise you on this point. Another way to generate cash, selling personal property. It is not uncommon to find a property listed for sale with numerous items of personal property on the premises. Depending on the seller's predicament, he or she might prefer to sell the items along with the home rather than incur the cost of moving them. It's not unusual to view homes in which the seller would not mind parting with appliances, pool tables, electronics, furniture, even automobiles. You might find that by purchasing the property, you're in a good position to entice the seller to give away valuable items outright. You might even include such items as non-essential contingencies in your offer. If the seller agrees to sell items of personal property, you can begin seeking out buyers, for example, by placing ads, before you even close on the property. At closing, you'll receive a bill of sale listing the items, thereby allowing you to sell them. A good example of this is a student of mine who received $25,000 from a lumber company in return for a promise to let them cut trees on a property that he was buying. And finally, generating cash by buying REO properties. Banked foreclosed properties often provide a great opportunity for purchases with no money down and cash back at closing. The bank's desire to sell the property might cause them to be very flexible in the terms of the sale. The following technique, illustrated by something that a friend did, actually consists of combining two techniques. First, buying foreclosed properties from a bank at a substantial discount. Banks call these properties real estate owned or REO properties. Banks would like to dispose of REOs as quickly as possible. You can offer to buy these properties from a bank for the foreclosed mortgage amount, and sometimes even less, which is frequently lower than the appraised value of the property. The second part of it is trading equity in a property you do not own for another property. You can often use equity in a property you do not even own as part of an offer that you're making on another property. This all sounds confusing? It's not. Let's take a look at the specifics. My friend went to a bank and asked the loan officer in charge of foreclosures, "What foreclosed property do you have that you would like most to sell?" The banker described a piece of vacant land on which the bank had foreclosed. The bank had originally loaned $60,000 on the property and wanted to get that property off its books. The buyer knew that good business practices require banks to obtain an appraisal as part of the foreclosure process. Also, he knew that banks typically lend 50% or less of the appraised value of vacant land. The banker showed the buyer the property's appraisal, which indicated a fair market value of $120,000. Now, keep in mind that property, especially vacant land, cannot always be sold quickly for its appraised value, sometimes not even quickly for half of its appraised value. The buyer then made several other offers on properties that were in the Multiple Listing Service, that's the MLS. The buyer's broker was more than willing to help locate properties through the information in the broker's MLS book for the purpose of making offers. In each of the offers made, the buyer used this vacant land at its appraised value of $120,000 as part payment of the purchase price. Two of the offers were accepted. Since he made sure that there was an escape clause in each offer, the buyer could choose to purchase either property. The property he selected was a $260,000 apartment building with an assumable loan of $115,000. The buyer arranged to assume the $115,000 loan and give the seller the vacant land appraised at $120,000 plus $40,000 in cash for a total price of $275,000. The $15,000 premium, that is $15,000 more than the seller was asking for the property, simply made the offer more attractive to the seller. The buyer had one remaining problem, which was finding $100,000 cash, $60,000 to purchase the vacant land, and $40,000 in cash for the seller. The buyer went back to the original bank that owned the vacant land. He asked the loan officer for a second mortgage on the apartment building he was trying to purchase. The banker said that they would loan up to 80% of the building's value, or $220,000. That's 80% of $275,000. And by the way, a bank appraiser will almost always appraise property for the amount of the contract if the negotiation between the buyer and seller was conducted at arm's length. Because a first mortgage of $115,000 already existed on the apartment building, the bank would loan an additional $105,000. That's a difference between 80% of the building's value, or $220,000, and the first mortgage of $115,000. With a $105,000 second mortgage, the buyer was able to pay for the vacant land, give the seller cash, and still have $5,000 left over. Here's how each party stood after this transaction. The bank's worst foreclosure property was sold for the full $60,000, the amount of the original loan. An additional $105,000 loan was made on the apartment building. And remember, banks are in the business of making loans, not sitting on foreclosed properties. The buyer, my student, now owns the apartment building without taking a penny out of his own pocket. What's more, he put $5,000 cash in his pocket at closing. Thus, by assuming a loan for $115,000 and obtaining a second mortgage for $105,000, he bought an apartment building worth $260,000 for an actual total cost of $220,000, and he received $5,000 in cash. An additional $40,000 of immediate profit was received in the form of equity in the building, $260,000 value, minus $220,000 in loans. In short, the buyer received $5,000 in cash and $40,000 in equity, netting him a whopping $45,000 in profits before taxes and closing costs. He got $45,000 profit at the closing. You may wonder why the buyer just didn't get a new first mortgage from the bank that had the REO in the amount of $220,000. It's my understanding from him that he would have, except that the mortgage he assumed had such an excellent interest rate and terms. Let's take a look at the seller's situation. The seller sold the property quickly, and as far as the seller was concerned, at more than the asking price. The existing loan of $115,000 was assumed by the buyer, and the seller acquired a piece of vacant land free of any liens and mortgages with an appraised value of $120,000. He also received $40,000 cash at close for a total selling price, as it was written, of $275,000. Okay, let's recap the material I've covered in this audio chapter. Sometimes you as a buyer might be able to get cash at closing for yourself even when you're buying a property with no money down. If you structure your transaction properly, you might generate cash not only for the seller, but for yourself as well. Wise planning and knowledge of my creative financing techniques can help you not only buy a property with no money down, but put cash in your pocket as well. Receiving cash at closing can help you ensure that needed repairs can be made or that you have cash reserves to help defray property maintenance expenses. You can structure cash at closing transactions using promissory notes, institutional lenders, sale of personal property, or sale and leaseback arrangements. To do so, you need to familiarize yourself fully with the seller's needs, the property's value, your resources, and the costs associated with the purchase. Your ability to obtain cash at closing could be a determining factor in whether or not the transaction is desirable. Getting cash at closing could turn a mediocre purchase opportunity into a fantastic deal. Likewise, an investment opportunity may seem more viable once you have the funds needed to complete repairs or to cover operating expenses. A word of caution. I was going to buy a motel on Siesta Key near Sarasota, Florida some time ago, and I was going to put in my pocket $250,000. The problem was that this property was going to have a negative cash flow of about $65,000 a year. The broker had a lot to lose, though, if I didn't buy the property, so he gave me an argument. He said, you know, you could take a portion of that $250,000, fix up the property, raise the rates, and very quickly you'll have a break-even cash flow. Well, that was enough to make me say, no, thank you. I don't take those kinds of chances. And I backed out of the proposition. Let me say, though, that many of my students have purchased property with no money down and received cash at closing and had excellent success in doing this.